It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about farm-to-school programs in our state and the logistical challenges they face.
First, transportation funding in the state could be in limbo as state legislators vowed to work on their own funding plan instead of the budget put forth by Governor Walker.
And this shakeup could leave smaller municipalities in the lurch as they undertake much-needed infrastructure projects throughout their communities.
Sean Johnson is with us now to talk about what's in store for transportation funding in our state. He's the Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what was in Governor Walker's transportation budget?
I think broadly speaking, when you look at the governor's transportation budget, it's gotten a lot of pushback from state lawmakers because it would delay or even cancel some big state road projects. The governor, as he said over and over again, was going to hold firm on against any gas tax or vehicle registration fee increase. And so you had less money than was needed to do all the projects. One thing the governor did prioritize in his budget, though, was funding for local roads. And so this is money that goes to cities, to counties, to towns. They all got a big bump in his budget. And so what you have now is legislators have set the governor's budget aside and said they're going to work from their own product. And it's left local governments wondering, basically, what does that mean for all that money that was promised to us?
So how common is that for the legislature to get the budget from the governor, look at a huge portion, I don't know what percentage it is, but the transportation part of that budget has to be a pretty big chunk, and say, you know what, we're just going to set this over here and start from scratch?
It's really rare. I mean, you rarely ever see that because, I mean, the governor's budget sets the table for budget deliberations. And so that's still going to happen in the general fund budget, for example. That's the budget for schools, healthcare, prisons, all that stuff. The legislature will work from the governor's product as their starting point. You know, he sets the blueprint there. And what they ultimately approve may end up looking a lot like what he introduced. In transportation, we're basically in a situation now where there is no blueprint. You know, that they're going to be working from what they call working from base. So what was approved last year, what's law now, is where they're starting from. And so it basically puts the governor and his proposals and his ideas, his priorities, on more of an equal footing with the legislators, and they're going to battle it out. And I'm not sure at this point exactly where they're heading on that.
Well, and we're certainly used to a lot of things getting battled out in politics, but not as often when everybody's from the same party.
Yeah,
so what does that say about the relationship between the governor and legislators of his own Republican Party?
I think it highlights how real this dispute is between Republicans, that they would take this unusual step to throw their own governor's budget on transportation aside. And, you know, just to give that a little bit more context, it's not to say that some of his ideas won't prevail and be in the final transportation budget. I mean, they may ultimately approve an increase in state funding for local roads. We just don't know. And so the fact that they would just say this budget, governor, that you've been talking about since September of last year, basically, is no more. You know, it's just another idea that we're going to consider, but you're not setting the table on this one.
We're talking with Sean Johnson. He's WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and we're looking at the deliberations going on around the transportation budget. The governor's transportation budget has been set aside by the legislature, and they're saying that they're going to start from scratch on their own. So, Sean, you said that in the governor's budget, these smaller municipalities that have huge needs were doing a little better than maybe they would have in another budget, but the legislators are looking at some of those really high ticket price items that were not covered fully in the governor's budget. So who's getting pitted against who here?
I think the view of the legislature and really of some lobbyists who work for local government organizations like the Counties Association, they sort of look at the way that the governor set up his budget and feel like he increased all this local road funding because he took it out of state projects. You know, there wasn't enough money in state projects that allowed him to give this influx of local road funding. So, I mean, that's sort of the trade-off. His budget was talking about a 13% increase in general transportation aid for counties and almost 9% increase for municipalities and towns at the same time that it was taking state road projects and either delaying them or just canceling them. So that was sort of the trade-off that you had in the governor's plan. I'm not sure that the legislature is going to want to flip it around exactly and put all their money in state projects, because they do have, especially in the assembly now, a number of lawmakers who represent districts who are really hungering for that funding. What you did hear, or what I heard from these groups that represent municipalities and counties when I talked to them yesterday, is that they would rather have a longer term, more sustainable transportation plan than just a 2-year increase that was called for in the governor's plan. Because, yeah, this budget was good for them. They would have gotten a big influx of money this time around. But a couple years later, maybe that money's not there. And maybe a few years later, they actually get cut because the state has to repair all these interstates that it's put off for years.
Mm-hmm. Sean, you spent a lot of time working on a multi-part series about transportation funding issues in the state. You talked to a lot of people in these municipalities. What are some of the projects that they have been really needing to take on and haven't had the funding for that really stand out in your memory that could very possibly be left on the floor if this budget is scrapped?
Well, I mean, the thing that sticks out in my mind is I talked to a lot of towns about how the budget would affect them and just their situation in road funding. And so, you know, when you look at what the governor proposed for them, an almost 9% increase in general aids, as I mentioned, that translates for the average town to about $10,000. So, you know, if you wanted to pave a mile of road, it's not even going to come anywhere close. At $10,000 is going to let you do a little maintenance on roads. So that's the situation they're in, where even when they're on paper some of the biggest winners in the governor's budget, in reality, that money people weren't really even going to notice it. You know, it was going to go toward maintenance that needed to be done, not toward repairing roads that have outlived their useful life. That's kind of what struck me, is that even as the legislature and the governor grapple over whether towns are going to get more, the state projects are going to get more, what that balance is going to be, the long-term issues facing roads in Wisconsin are still going to be there. You know, they're not just going to go away, even if they approve like a more long-term, you know, transportation budget.
And Sean, as we start to wrap up, so the governor's budget is done. The legislature is working on their own transportation budget. They'll look to the governor's budget for other large things like education and other issues. At what point does something get voted on or something get settled on?
You're going to see the Joint Finance Committee has a few more public hearings scheduled on the budget next week. I think they're going to probably start voting on pieces of the budget soon after that. I think with the transportation budget, they'll start voting when they reached a deal. And they're going to be talking privately, I think, for a while to try to reach that deal. But every indication we've seen so far is that the divisions when it comes to that funding, especially between like Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and the governor, are very real. And so they've got a lot to get passed. And it's not going to be any easier, I don't think, with the governor's budget out of the picture.
Well, Sean, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is the Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us to talk about the governor's transportation budget and how cities throughout the state could be affected by the change. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, the for-profit college industry has grown significantly in the past 2 decades, but how are their students faring?
First, the local food movement has been gaining steam for years, and schools are getting in on the action. From field trips to local farms to setting up their own vegetable gardens, many schools in the state are teaching students the importance of where our food comes from.
Scott Gordon joins us now. He's a reporter for WisContext, and his recent article on the challenges that farm-to-school food programs faced is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. We're also joined by Mike Gasper, Nutrition Services Supervisor for the School District of Holman, Wisconsin. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Scott, let's start with you. Give us an overview of the different kinds of programs around our state that are doing some kind of farm-to-school effort.
So generally, farm-to-school means a few different things. Obviously, the one that most people think of is, you know, buying ingredients from local farms to serve at school lunch. But people who kind of work on these things professionally also include in that definition things like field trips to farms or other sort of food or nutrition or agriculture-related educational activities, as well as things like having school gardens.
Okay. And do we know from a census how many schools in Wisconsin participate in these kinds of programs?
Yeah. So the most recent kind of reliable and thorough census of that came in 2015. The USDA has something called the Farm to School Census, and the next one isn't happening until 2019. But the 2015 one showed that, you know, about half of the school districts and private schools in Wisconsin had some form of farm to school, and that, you know, it reached more than 500,000 students in the state.
And Mike, can you give us an idea of what you're doing in the Holman School District?
Sure. We kind of do a little bit of everything, actually. We've done some farm tours. We've done school gardens. We've raised chickens, actually, here that we've used in our lunch program. We purchased some local farmers. We're part of the La Crosse County Farm School Program as well. So we're actually pretty involved with the program.
And I understand raising chickens, you had to do quite a bit of workarounds to get these chickens from raising them to be able to serve them in your school cafeteria.
Yes. The biggest requirement that we faced was trying to find a processing facility that was USDA inspected, which we found one about 45 minutes away. But then the other issue became transporting the frozen chicken back to the district. You can't just throw it in the back of a pickup truck or a cooler and hope it's going to be okay by the time you get there. So we had to make sure it was done correctly, which we then contacted our prime vendor, which was Reinhardt Foods, and they were willing to do it, but they were regulated where they couldn't transport something they didn't own and that insurance was carried on. So to get around all that, we basically became a producing member of Fifth Season Co-op in Viroqua. So we sold the chicken to them, who sold it to Reinhardt, and then we bought it back from Reinhardt in order to arrange for the transportation of it.
Is it worth it?
Absolutely. You know, just from the standpoint alone of the educational benefit that the kids got, you know, being a part of that from start to finish and helping work through some of the logistical issues, I think it was invaluable to those kids. And then when you actually are here on the day that we serve that chicken to all of our schools, and you see the kids' faces and you hear the comments about, you know, wow, this is so good. And, you know, a lot of kids probably haven't really had real food like that before. You know, they're used to process stuff, and to be able to serve something real that they created, I think, is just incredible.
Scott, you write that districts with farm-to-school programs often have to go through some supply chain gymnastics, even to get, like, vegetables, fruit, or milk from area farms to their cafeterias. What are schools up against in trying to get locally sourced ingredients into school lunches?
Well, what Mike just described is a great example, albeit maybe kind of a unique one, because, as I understand it, not a lot of schools are going quite so far as, you know, raising their own meat and things like that. But still, if a school district wants to get access to local produce, you know, generally if it's buying from a big food distributor like Sysco or what have you, they're not going to be able to get a lot of that through that company. So they have to figure out some other way to do it. And, you know, this can involve a lot of things like what Mike was describing, which is seeing if your distributor will buy stuff or if there's some kind of workaround you can get to get a hold of that, or if you can work individually or collectively with the different farms in your area. You know, and then on top of that, there's the complexity of just trying to figure out, what you need and how to get good prices on it and how to adjust to price changes and different things. I believe when I talked to Mike for one of my stories this week, he mentioned sometimes the Holman schools like to serve Brussels sprouts, but they can't always do it because the prices on Brussels sprouts vary, and sometimes it's just not fiscally responsible for them. So it's, you know, it's really quite complicated. Like, as much as it's become this really popular idea, and clearly a lot of schools around the state and the country are getting more interested in doing it, there is no roadmap for how to really make it happen.
We're talking right now with Scott Gordon. He's a reporter for WisContext. And Mike Gasper, he's Nutrition Services Supervisor for the School District of Holman, which has a number of farm-to-school programs. We're talking about farm-to-school programs here in Wisconsin. Scott, apparently Wisconsin is considering to eliminate its farm-to-school coordinator in the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. What might that mean for the future of farm-to-school programs?
Well, even without that position, there will still be people on staff in state government, particularly at the Department of Public Instruction, who work on farm-to-school issues and local food issues. But you know, what a lot of the school districts and farmers and advocates involved in this whole farm-to-school realm are saying is that this coordinator, and that job is currently vacant right now, by the way.
Since May.
Yeah. Has been instrumental in sort of bringing people together, different parties who might not always completely understand each other's workings. You know, a school might not understand how a farm works. A farm might not understand how a school's food service program works. Basically, they've said this coordinator has really helped to sort of bring all these different parties together and figure out ways for them to work together, you know, figure out things like, you know, how to raise chickens and sell them to back to yourself while complying with all the regulations and so forth. So I think that's the piece that people really seem to value about that particular position.
Mike, what would you say? How did the farm-to-school coordinator help your district?
You know, it was when we were going through the whole chicken process and trying to figure it out, we contacted that office numerous times, and they were able to do some research and really kind of led us to this workaround that we ended up finding. You know, I think it's a great resource for school districts that haven't done farm to school and maybe are interested but really have no idea where to start. You know, when you look at the total amount of money that is spent in the Wisconsin economy by school food services, you're talking millions and millions of dollars. And to have somebody that can maybe help direct some of that directly into local economies, I think is well worth the price of the salary of the person.
Mike, what advice do you have for schools that would like to follow in your footsteps and pursue similar farm-to-school programs?
You know, the biggest thing is to start someplace. Pick something and start. A lot of times with distributors like Reinhardt, they do purchase quite a bit of local produce from places like Fifth Season Co-op. That you can get right off the order guide now. That's kind of a relatively new thing within the last couple of years. That's a great place to start with no real work involved. You know, you just have to identify what products those are, bring them into your operation. You know, we started off in the beginning with the local orchard, getting all of our apples from this local orchard. I think you just got to get into it. And once you get into it, you'll see the kids really enjoying it, and I think it makes you want to do more. So, you know, we've evolved now where we have school gardens. We have at all of our schools, we have sweet corn gardens actually out in the community. And we're actually going to progress this year. In addition to doing chickens, we're going to be doing pigs that will utilize all the meat in the school food service program.
There is always that fear out there that says, well, what if the kids don't like the food? What do you do?
We've found when the kids are invested in it, so when it's food that they've grown in their own garden or, say, chickens or hopefully pigs, they absolutely love it. I think they just take a much different attitude towards it. A lot of times, you know, a kid will say, oh, I don't like squash, and then you'll ask them, well, have you tried it? Well, no, I've never tried it. I just don't like it. You know, so when they're invested in the actual growing of it, preparing it, serving it, I think it changes attitudes, and really changes the way kids eat today. And I think, you know, in our district, we've turned a lot of kids on to a lot of products like Brussels sprouts that they never would have tried, and now are eating healthier because of it.
Scott, as we look to wrap up and you look into that crystal ball of food service for schools here in Wisconsin, do you see farm-to-school programs continuing to grow, or are they going to stagnate? What might happen next?
Well, you know, it's hard to predict, of course, but even in that survey that I mentioned from a couple of years ago, a lot of school districts that didn't yet have farm-to-school programs told the USDA they were hoping to start programs in the near future. So I'm sure there might be some additional obstacles if this farm-to-school coordinator position gets cut or remains unfilled as it is now. But there does seem to be a broader momentum around these things and an interest kind of all around the state that seems to transcend, you know, political variations or the, you know, urban and rural variations. It really seems to be kind of spreading in a really diverse way. So I think that will likely continue to drive these programs forward somehow.
And Mike, it looks like you guys are just growing in the number of programs you're working on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got the things I mentioned before. We're also working on trying to raise some money to expand our greenhouse. We have a hydroponic lettuce operation in our greenhouse that supplies lettuce to our high school. And we're hoping to, at some point, if we can expand it, provide lettuce throughout the district. And again, that's actually written into our agriculture, science, and math curriculum as well. So again, it goes back to that whole education thing. It kind of ties everything together, and I think it's just a really great program. It takes a little bit of work to get there, but once you get it up and running, it's fantastic.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Absolutely.
And Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Scott Gordon is a reporter for WisConText, and Mike Gasper is the Nutrition Services Supervisor for the School District of Holman, Wisconsin. We have Scott Gordon's WisConText article linked on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, stem cell researchers from around the world are convening in Madison next week for a symposium. We'll learn about what Wisconsin scientists are bringing to the table.
First, chances are you've heard or seen a commercial like this in the past few years.
At Globe University, we believe in preparing career-focused, community-minded graduates for the global workforce. We do this by providing industry-designed curriculum centered on real-world experience and application. We offer associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degrees, as well as diploma and certificate programs. With over 130 years' experience, we've streamlined our programs to get you on the job as quickly as possible. As a student, you will experience a staff and faculty who care about your success and call you by name, not number. Globe University is accredited by the Accrediting Council for Independent Colleges and Schools.
The for-profit college industry has grown tremendously in the past few decades, both in classroom and virtual settings. Proponents say that they are a valuable resource for students who don't perform well in traditional settings and that they provide needed workers for a variety of industries.
But critics say that they prey on students with few other options and who don't have the support system to allow them to get into or succeed in four-year colleges. And that because they are in business to earn money for shareholders, the students suffer.
Tressie McMillan-Cottom worked in enrollment at two for-profit colleges. After experiencing the kinds of choices students faced, she left the for-profit educational sector to go study it in graduate school. She's now an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She joins us now to talk about her new book, Lower Ed: The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Tressie, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me here at Central Time.
Well, as we mentioned, for-profit colleges have expanded tremendously in the past two decades. Mm-hmm. What conditions and public policies account for that growth?
That's a great question, because I think that's actually the question. It's not so much that everybody woke up in around 1995 and 1996 and decided that they all just wanted to go to college, right? That something usually has happened when you see that sort of mass enrollment, change in enrollment behaviors. And my argument is that a few things happened. The first thing that happened is that the labor market became a little less hospitable to people who didn't have a college degree. Right, is actually not that hospitable for people who have a college degree, but it's really inhospitable for those who do not. And increasingly what people were experiencing is that without a college degree, they could not get a foothold into an occupational path that would allow them to move up over their career and lifetime. What had once been typical for workers, which was that you would get a job, work with an employer, maybe two or three over your lifetime, but that over time, your pay and salary and status at work would increase over time, right? That sort of social contract had really changed. Increasingly, what employers were saying to workers was that, listen, we not only won't promise you job security or pay or job quality into your older years, we won't even guarantee that next year, right? That we increasingly needed to be individually responsible for making sure that we were always career ready, because increasingly we will always need to be looking for the next job as employers downshift labor to manage cost in the short term. So workers were feeling that, right? That makes people feel really insecure. On the flip side of that, social policy didn't have a response. Right, so both of these things are happening, sort of a squeeze in the labor market and then a vacuum among social policy. On the social policy side, a couple of things did happen, and then lots of things that probably should have happened didn't happen. One thing that happened for the poorest workers, those that sort of dance along the line of being poor, so, you know, might dip below the poverty level one year, sort of get a better job the next and be above it or right at it, that kind of sort of cycling in and out of poverty, which is actually quite common. Those workers were finding that social policy benefits like the story at the top of your hour, things like food subsidies, were becoming much more difficult to obtain, lots of new rules to obtain them, and they were becoming more hostile to helping poor people as states tried to manage the cost of those programs. So those things that had been put in place as a safety net for poorer workers were becoming increasingly frayed. At the same time, we did not see any social policy to help workers, right, to help them manage things like the rising cost of health care or the rising cost of education. So at the same time that workers are feeling really, really insecure, the social safety net is fraying and changing, and people are trapped there in the middle. And the only response that we've been willing to give them from both a federal and a state policy level is, oh, you need to go to college, right? Mm-hmm. College will solve this problem for you. Well, when college becomes the only solution for millions of people, millions of people try to figure out the most efficient way to do college and to try to do it the sort of easiest, most direct route possible. And what for-profit colleges really figured out early on was, oh, that's what will sell people, a very direct route to job security that promises them that they'll always be career ready. They just have to sign on the dotted line.
And so, Tressie, you talk quite a bit in your book, Lower Ed, about how the people that you were encountering when you were a recruiter and enrollment person for first a beauty college and then a technical college were people that really just didn't have the kind of structures in place that other people mm-hmm. who might go to a four-year college would. Right. Can you give us an example of the kind of folks that were coming through the door?
Sure. So the beauty school in many ways represented those smaller for-profit college chains that were mostly local or regional schools that every community has. So not just the beauty school, but things like the auto mechanic school, those sorts of short-term occupational certificates. Those students were much more likely to be African-American, Hispanic, working poor, or poor. They were also more likely to be women. And for all of the reasons that are related to what we know in how inequality works in our society, those people had very few of the sort of social supports to help make them successful in college. The number one thing that they didn't have was that they were less likely to have attended a really competitive or well-resourced, well-supported K through 12 school. Well, we know that matters a lot, right? If you go to a poor K through 12 school, you tend to graduate with sort of all of the inequalities that were baked into your K through 12 experience. And those students tend to be less likely to be prepared for going on to what we call a traditional college experience. On the other side of that was the technical school, which offered sort of higher level degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, et cetera. And those students were more likely to be male than the students at the beauty school, a little less likely to be African American and Hispanic, and almost all of those students were working while they were going to school. So for those students, it was a different type of inequality. Their inequality was that they may have had some preparation for college, but not enough preparation for a competitive college education. And the biggest thing they didn't have is they didn't have the income or the family support, which is just really, you know, a proxy for wealth. When you have family members who can help, you know, sort of smooth over the rough edges of your life, that's usually a function of wealth. And so if you don't come from a family that was wealthy, what they couldn't afford to do is they couldn't afford to quit their job to pursue a traditional college education. So even though their scenario was a little better off than the students at the beauty school, those students were still experiencing some inequalities.
We're talking with Tressie McMillan-Cottom right now. She is the author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. So let's break this down, Tressie. How do for-profit colleges make their money?
Well, they make their money almost unilaterally from tuition. Tuition is their, for most for-profit colleges, sort of their singular source of revenue. The larger corporately controlled for-profit college chains, the ones with the big national name brands that we really recognize, things like the University of Phoenix and Strayer and ITT and Capella, those brands distribute that money to corporate shareholders. But even the privately owned for-profit colleges are doing what we call extracting profit from revenue, tuition money, to pay to private owners. So what we see, since the majority of for-profit college students, something like 97% of them, rely on federal student aid programs to pay their tuition, what you see is that for-profit colleges are almost a one-to-one extraction tool. They extract money from the federal student aid system and then distribute it to either shareholders or private owners as revenue or profit. So they make their money from tuition, so the only way they can be more profitable year over year is to do one of two things. They can make education less expensive to provide, right, so they can provide cheaper education, or they can increase the price of tuition. And either way, for students, that's not usually a very good scenario.
And what do we know about the graduation rates in those for-profit college programs compared to the more traditional college programs?
Mm-hmm. We know that students who attend for-profit colleges are less likely to graduate than students who have similar characteristics who attend traditional colleges. We know that when they do drop out, that they have more student loan debt than if they'd attended a not-for-profit college or university. We know that even of the students who finish, and again, the majority of those who enroll in a for-profit college won't finish, but even among those who do, we find that when they try to go to work, they are more likely to be unemployed. When they're unemployed for longer. And when they do secure employment, don't earn demonstrably more than someone who does not have a degree. So from the point of dropping out, the college dropout rates are pretty abysmal, and it's actually probably the biggest sort of problem, I think, with whether or not for-profit colleges are a good public investment for us. But I say you have to compare the worst-case scenario, which is, for us, the high dropout rates and the debt load that students carry, in the for-profit college sector and say, well, okay, well, maybe that's worth it if the best-case scenario is really good, right? And the best-case scenario even in the for-profit college sector is actually not so good. And so when you have a pretty bad, a pretty low worst-case scenario, and then a not-so-good best-case scenario, the for-profit college sector, I argue, becomes one that's really defined by being high risk.
Tressie McMillan-Cottom worked for two different for-profit colleges before she decided to study the industry as a graduate student and now as an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's with us to discuss her new book, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you attended a for-profit college like University of Phoenix, Globe University, Madison Media Institute, DeVry University, or others? What was the experience like for you? Did you get what you needed out of the program? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Tressie McMillan-Cottom. She combines her personal experiences and academic research in her new book, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy.
And we want to hear from you. Have you attended a for-profit college? And if you finished the program, how would you rate how much it improved your life and the life of your family, considering the costs involved? If you didn't finish the program, what happened? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Tressie, I want to go back to your experience actually working for the for-profit colleges and what made you leave there. You were first at the beauty college, then at the technical college. And what was it like being a recruiter for the technical college?
Being a recruiter at the technical college was defined by, the thing that comes to mind when I try to, remember the experience of it was the sense of time, right? It was a very fast-paced job. And even when there wasn't a lot to do in my daily tasks, there was a lot of pressure for everything to be done very quickly. It was a very quick job. And in many ways, that relationship to time, how fast could we make the enrollment process? How quickly could we convert prospective students to enrolled students so that they could become a tuition-generating student? All of that for me was about how much the process of enrolling students at the technical college was about speeding it up, right? So when you would call like a 1-800 number after hearing one of the ads about how to change your life today, someone like me at the time would have answered the phone on the other end. And my number one job when I picked up that phone was to first of all get your contact information so that I could make sure I had a way to get in touch with you. But then also make sure I could get you to come visit the campus as soon as possible, not in a week, not in 2 weeks, not during fall visitation day, something that those of us at traditional colleges might feel familiar with, but to get you to come visit today or maybe tomorrow, at the latest 2 days from now, right? Because the idea was to try to capture people in the moment when they were feeling sort of the most insecure, the most vulnerable, and perhaps the most committed to the idea of thinking about school. And I needed to talk to you in that moment. And next week, 2 weeks was really far too long when I considered how fast people's lives were when they were complicated by things like childcare and work and caring for parents and all of those things that are very common for for-profit college students. And so my job was about, really trying to make that process happen as quickly as possible. So there were lots of pressures from both above management and below the students to make that process as seamless and as fast as possible.
Let's go to the phones, and we'll start with Mark in Wauwatosa. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
Well, I was relating my experience. I actually had taught at one of the for-profit colleges. I won't name the college, but I went through grad school, and while I was in grad school, had an opportunity to teach a couple, 100-level, 400-level classes in the conventional college, and I found myself having to dumb down the curriculum, and we were encouraged to not fail people that needed help or that perhaps, weren't really coming along the way they should. And so I spent a lot of extra time myself personally just, regrading papers and spending office hour time that I had. I was used to doing that in the conventional college, but when it came to the for-profit college, it seemed that, the most important thing was to pass the students so that, they could collect the money. And then there weren't really a lot of deviations from the, from the curriculum. Being an environmental person, I was actually, I took one of my classes on a field trip, kind of a hands-on thing. It was a great learning experience from the student's perspective, but really wasn't a lot of, I don't want to say attaboy, but there wasn't really a lot of appreciation for doing a little bit extra. That was a real true learning experience. So,
thanks for that call, Mark. And Tracy, does Mark's experience sound familiar to you?
Oh, I'm so happy to hear from Mark. First of all, thanks for calling, Mark. It's always great to hear from people who have taught within for-profit colleges. They don't actually figure that prominently in my book just because there was so much other stuff I needed to talk about. But I love that Mark gives me a chance to talk about that very thing. Yes, his experience is quite typical for a couple of reasons. So one thing he mentioned was the sort of pressure, and sometimes not direct, but the indirect and the direct pressure to sort of pass students along. Well, one of the reasons why this happens in the for-profit college sector is, remember those inequalities we talked about in the K-12 system mm-hmm. that produces a lot of students that aren't always ready for college-level work. Well, one of the things that traditional colleges have done, especially public higher education, is invested a lot of money in what we call remedial courses. Right? Those are those courses you take to get you up to speed for things like college-level writing and college-level math. Well, everybody hates them, and of course you do, right? Because they're hard, and the students, struggle in them, and they take a lot of resources, but they're valuable, right? This is one of the ways that college sort of supports the education mission of public education K-12 by providing that service. In for-profit colleges, because those courses are so expensive to provide and because the student consumer doesn't like taking them because they are difficult, for-profit colleges tend not to either offer them or they certainly don't offer them at the beginning when the student begins school. And so what you see instead is this incentive to make sure students are enjoying their college experience, right, so that they keep showing up and so that we keep getting the tuition payments on their behalf. So there's a profit motive there to making sure the students enjoy school. Well, the problem is when enjoyment is in conflict with making sure they get their skills up to speed for college-level work. And that's actually quite common across for-profit colleges. One executive said to me in our interview when we talked about that, they said, well, yeah, you got to hook them with the enjoyable stuff first. So we don't front-load, the remedial courses because it's too discouraging for students. They drop out. And if they drop out too soon, then you don't get the full tuition payment for them from the federal government, right? So that's the profit motive. And then the other thing Mark talked about that came up with lots of teachers that I know who have worked in the for-profit college sector is how little control they have over the curriculum. One of the hallmarks of traditional higher education is something that we call faculty governance, right? And that's the idea that your professors have pretty much, control over how they will design the course and teach it within some guidelines. That is actually not the case in for-profit colleges, and that is by design. So when you read all of the financial documents, for example, of the corporate for-profit colleges, they talk a lot about, oh, well, we don't have to worry about paying our faculty a lot to develop curriculum, which would be an expense, which would cut into revenue, which would cut into profit. We develop all of our curriculum at a central office, and then we ship it out to people like Mark, and we just have him teach it the way that we've written it. And so, yes, that's by design to keep the labor cost of teaching in the for-profit college sector low so that you can increase how much profit you can extract.
Well, Tressie, there's so much in your book that I wanted to get to, but unfortunately we are out of time. So thank you so much for being with us today. You have a really unique perspective on this.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's wonderful to talk to you today.
Tressie McMillan-Cotton is the author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. It's National Pet Day, and as happy cat owners, we thought we'd look into some of the reasons that pets are good for us.
It turns out that petting your dog, cat, or other companion animal can lower your blood pressure, it helps your body release a relaxation hormone, and it cuts down on levels of a stress hormone, and as a bonus, it's calming for your pet as well.
It's been shown that people with pets are generally happier, more trusting, and less lonely than those who don't have pets. One reason that doctors give for that may be that your pet gives you a sense of belonging and of meaning.
Dogs can improve your health, since most dog owners end up walking their pooches. And remember that next time that you have to take your dog out in the dark in sub-zero temperatures.
But the best reason to have a pet, they're just great companions, and they make life so much better. We've posted some photos of our own pets on the Central Time Facebook page and would love to see yours there too.
So from Django, Sears Poisson, and Maddie Kent, happy National Pet Day.
Cat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat eyes. What's new, pussycat?
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Happy National Pet Day.